Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And I'm Sean Whelan, RTE's correspondent in London.
And I'm Colm O'Mungo, RTE's deputy foreign editor in Dublin. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
This week, do we have a Brexit breakthrough? There was optimism in Liverpool, silence in London and croissants for breakfast in Brussels.
Indeed, at the luxury wedding venue of Thornton Manor in Cheshire, Boris Johnson and Leo Varadkar exchanged vows. But what exactly transpired at the three-hour meeting that led to the promise of a Brexit deal by the end of the month?
I'll be assessing the meeting and the chemistry between the two men and where things go next.
Where things went next was Brussels and a Brexit breakfast for Michel Barnier and Brexit Secretary Steve Barclay, who was to bring fresh proposals that reflected the outcome of the Johnson-Varadkar meeting.
But what are those fresh proposals? We'll peer through the fog and ponder whether or not there's a tunnel, and we'll even explain what the tunnel is.
But first, Sean, take us through the cloak and dagger rendezvous near Liverpool, and what does it have to do with Colleen Rooney?
Well, Colleen Rooney, the woman of the week, the ace investigator. Did she have a role in disclosing this secret location at a wedding venue in the Wirral near Liverpool? Apparently not, but she is somewhat local to the area and apparently held her 21st birthday party there, which of course made it an attraction for photographers, paparazzi, local newspaper people, tabloid reporters. And they were the ones, of course, who sniffed out the venue bright and early in the morning, got there, parked themselves up and were able to video Boris Johnson and his motorcade arriving at this top secret venue, which they then put out on social media, and all the rest of the world's media descended upon it immediately. They had hoped to keep it as quiet as possible. Obviously, the plan was that the two prime ministers and a small group of officials on each side, about four or five people on each side, would go to this place away from all the media attention and away from the necessity of having press conferences and the sometimes confrontational approach that can follow from that, and taking a much more relaxed approach. And it seems to have paid off. Certainly the mood music improved a lot, but it was great fun in the sense of racing up to Liverpool, running around the place, meeting up with gangs of journalists who were scouring the land, trying to find exactly where this wedding venue was.
You make it sound like a Beatles caper movie in keeping with the city.
It almost was. But then as the rain started to set in, we were more or less happy to be locked up in a Liverpool airport for several hours waiting for the meeting to end. We'd originally thought it was going to be fairly short-ish meeting. That there wasn't much optimism on the Irish side that this was going to be a big breakthrough meeting. So we had to hang around. In fact, the journos were locked up in this room in Liverpool Airport for longer than the meeting itself took. So, and the meeting itself ran for 3 hours. So people were a little bit running out of oxygen by the time Leo Varadkar arrived to give a very short briefing to the media. And the briefing consisted of, I'm not telling you any of the details here, but I'm more optimistic than I was this morning.
You know, we agreed not to get into the details of any proposals or discussions made. But on the timeline question, I think it is possible for us to come to an agreement, to have a treaty agreed to allow the UK to leave the EU in an orderly fashion and to have that done by the end of October. But there is many a slip between cup and lip and lots of things that are not in my control.
There's a lot of unknowns coming out of this meeting. We don't know what the detail of what was discussed, but do we know, even in terms of the logistics of the meeting, who requested it, how was the venue decided on, how did they decide to get into the secrecy of it, why the optimism afterwards? There was a lot of tick-tacking in advance of it, but what do we know about the choreography around the meeting, Sean?
Well, you're right. There was a lot of tic-tacking in advance, and backstop issue has been built up to a situation where it was always going to come down to some kind of a meeting between the British and the Irish. And that was probably going to be the make or break on whether the backstop, in whatever format it lives, would live on in some kind of an agreement. So these are the two most affected parties, the British and the Irish. They have to have some kind of an understanding about where this is going. And if they don't, well, yeah, it's not the type of thing that can be centrally directed from Brussels. So they had to get together at some point. There have been these short meetings with them. There have been telephone conversations. But the benefit of going off-site, out of office, off to a place like that wedding venue in the Wirral, was that they can just stay together and spend time together and strike up a relationship. And okay, how much of a relationship can anybody strike up in the course of 3 hours? But, you know, politicians do what politicians do, and one of their skills is striking a relationship, of being able to look somebody in the eye and decide, can I do business with this person? Yes or no? And then trying to do business with them. And I think that's what was going on with Boris Johnson and Leo Varadkar. The photographs that were released, mostly from the Taoiseach's office, it had to be said, showed them in fairly informal poses, but spending time together, even doing banal things like walking in the gardens of the place, talking to each other. But most of that meeting, we gather, was just the two of them talking to one another. The official teams were outside of the main meeting. They would have been doing their own talking, of course, and then the officials joined for the latter third of the meeting. But most of it was about these two leaders in a room together, trying to figure out a pathway through it, and then coming out afterwards and telling us, well, not very much in the case of Leo Varadkar, and nothing at all in the case of Boris Johnson. Now, Mr. Johnson did come out on Friday afternoon in London to make some brief comments, but again said, I'm not getting into details on this.
Well, I can certainly tell you that under no circumstances will we see anything that damages the ability of the whole of the United Kingdom to take full advantage of Brexit. And I think that's what people would expect. And that's what I think we can achieve. But the best thing now, really, would be for the negotiators to get on and do their job.
Just one last try on Brexit. Can you tell me categorically that Northern Ireland is leaving the EU customs union?
I think it would be wrong of me to give a running commentary on the negotiations. And why, with the greatest possible respect, I think, look at everything that I've said previously. I think you can draw your own conclusions from that, but let's let our negotiators get on. I think where Leo Varadkar and I got to yesterday was a joint feeling that there is a way forward. We can see a pathway to a deal. That doesn't mean it's a done deal, so there's work to be done.
So they want to keep it as tight as possible, try and move the thing forward somehow in the a negotiating process, but once those two had produced something viable, they could then send it to Brussels and see how it would play with the other 26.
Well, Tony, as Sean says there, there were positive noises from Leo Varadkar on exiting the meeting. We know that customs and consent were two of the areas around which the optimism grew at the meeting, but we don't know the detail. But do we know whose idea this novel proposal was going into the meeting?
Well, the two key issues, as you mentioned there, and as Sean was talking about, are customs and consent. Customs, of course, the whole problem is that the UK tabled their text and their proposals to replace the backstop, but all it did was to leave a customs border on the island of Ireland, one that they said could be managed through technology and exemptions and data exchange and so on. And the other big problem, of course, was the consent issue, and obviously Boris Johnson hoping to keep the DUP on board by giving them or the Stormont Executive and Assembly some kind of oversight or even veto on whether or not these proposals came into effect, or this arrangement came into effect, or how long it would last. So the problem is that, you know, how do you get around those two very fundamental difficulties? And paradoxically, one way to look at it is that you put the two of them together and link them so that if one side gives something on customs, say, the other side can give something on consent. Now, in a sense, the Irish could move on consent because they have always argued that they don't want a time limit to the backstop. But if you wrap a time limit up with the consent issue, then that shows that you're shifting. And then that would perhaps give some room to the British side to shift on the nature of customs. Now, we can get into the detail of what's been proposed shortly, but that, I think, was the choreography and the positioning of this. But I would have to say that in the run-up to the meeting in the Wirral, there was a lot of negativity in Brussels, and it was captured by Michel Barnier in the European Parliament on Wednesday, when he delivered his most searing critique of the British proposals yet.
But what we're being asked for in reality is to accept a system that hasn't been properly developed, that hasn't been tested. There'll be controls spread out across Ireland, and it will largely be based on exemptions and derogations, on technology that has yet to be developed, changes to international law.
Remember, the British tabled their new plan on the 2nd of October. They sent their team of negotiators over, but the negotiators weren't really negotiating. They were simply being bombarded with questions by EU officials as to their plans on customs and on consent. How on earth would they work? How would they comply with the EU customs code? A voluminous, highly complex piece of legislation. How would the proposals comply with WTO rules? How would they comply with the International Common Transit Convention? So they weren't really negotiations in a give and take sense at all. And I think British officials were getting very frustrated at this, because the moment they were saying, well, if that doesn't work, then what do you think would work? But the EU side were saying, well, we're not getting into that. We're just asking you questions. So things kind of came to a head at the European Parliament on Wednesday when Michel Barnier said, for lots of reasons, the UK proposals were simply not workable. They were not legally enforceable. They did not provide the security of the backstop. They didn't protect the All-Ireland economy. They were based on technology and ideas that were yet to be proven. And he summed it up by saying, I just don't think at this stage we can get an agreement. And then the very next day, we had a sudden sunburst of optimism from Liverpool.
So can we assume that the Irish side had some role in coming up with the idea that has proven to be a possible bridge in this pathway?
Well, I think we must assume that something in the chemistry between Leo Varadkar and Boris Johnson on Thursday in Liverpool, and also their meeting in Dublin. Remember, they did talk alone on that occasion for quite some time. And there has been quite a bit of tic-tacking between Dublin and London on this, various ministerial visitations as well. So we can assume that there has been something of a pre-cookery going on. There was also, obviously, a very close contact between Dublin and the European Commission. Simon Coveney made a trip to Brussels on Tuesday night, which kind of surprised quite a few people, because he had been wrapped up in the budget delivery all day on Tuesday. He'd been at a press conference at 4:30 in the afternoon on Tuesday, and yet he still hopped on a jet to fly to Brussels to meet Michel Barnier for about an hour and a half on Tuesday night. And people were wondering, well, why, you know, what's the point of this meeting? So we can possibly assume that some of this was being prepared at that meeting. And then all day Thursday, there were contacts between Dublin and the task force. So everybody was kept in the loop. Although I would have to say that member states on the other side of the Brussels sausage machine were a little bit mystified and a little bit in the dark as to what was happening. So to cut a long story short, Steve Barclay came to Brussels on Friday morning, had his breakfast with Michel Barnier, and everyone assumes that he brought the new proposals with him for Michel Barnier to go through. And then Michel Barnier, in turn, went to brief member states through the EU ambassadors forum, which is called CoRepair. And again, that was quite heavily shrouded in secrecy and lack of detail. Now, these co-repair briefings are often quite leaky affairs because you have 17 member states involved, and you know it's unsurprising that stuff gets leaked out. But on this occasion, it has been very tightly controlled. But what they did confirm was that there was sufficient content in Steve Barclay's proposals to get things moving, to get the negotiations up and running. And that gets us into the question of the tunnel, because we remember back in the...
Well, just before we get to the tunnel, if we can just interject at this point. After the optimism yesterday, Sean, back in London, I heard Nigel Evans from the ERG, the European Research Group, the Eurosceptic hardliner group within the Tory party, speaking on the Today programme. He didn't seem that bothered about the optimism. He certainly didn't seem worried about the optimism that was being expressed. Does Boris Johnson have the Tory party on board? Does he have the Spartans behind him?
Well, good question. And if they are behind him, what kind of weapons are they holding in their hands? I mean, on Friday afternoon, Boris Johnson said this isn't a done deal. So he's urging a little bit of caution and saying, look, let's leave it to the negotiators. As for the Spartans themselves, well, last week at the Tory party conference, Marc Francois was saying if this there's a deal that's done that actually gets Britain out of the European Union, I will be the first one into the I lobby to vote for it. But if it doesn't get Britain out by the 31st, or properly out of the European Union, then he'll vote against it. Now, there's been numbers games going on all the time in Westminster, trying to calculate who would vote for things, who would vote against things. There was reports from the Tory chief whip a couple of weeks ago that he reckons maybe about 9 or 10 Spartans might want to die guarding the pass, but that might be it. On the other hand, it might be more or it might be fewer. We just don't know at the moment. They seem to have been holding their powder a bit dry. The closer we get to the actual hard reality, the more minds are getting concentrated. Certainly the news flow here in the UK has not been good when it comes to economic matters. The Institute for Fiscal Studies earlier in the week published a document looking at the economic effects of Brexit and what the government would have to do in terms of its own borrowing plan. They think they'll have to double the size of the deficit to about 4%. I mean, we had the Irish budget earlier in the week talking about a 0.6% deficit being run as a result of Brexit. Here, the IFS talking about a negative 4% deficit being run.
Right. Once an economics editor, always an economics editor, Sean.
Well, always. But I mean, look, the bottom line of this thing is that Britain would spend about £100 billion pumping up the economy, cutting taxes, increasing spending. And at the end of that 2 years, they would achieve net economic growth of zero. Zero. So you're spending £100 billion just to stand still. And then there they are talking about saving £12 billion a year on EU membership fees. The Treasury on Tuesday published a report saying that the cost of filling in customs declarations is going to be about £15 billion a year. So just on that single calculation alone, you're down £3 billion by being outside of the customs union and having all of this additional customs regulation. It's going to cost apparently £27 for every form you fill in if you're employing your own staff, and it'll take them an hour and 45 minutes to do it. These are the kind of additional costs that have been piling on, and that kind of hard, bad news has been concentrating minds, I think.
Okay, so that might give some of the context as to what's concentrating the minds. Tony, the tunnel, what is it? Have these factors played into it, and are we there?
Well, okay, the tunnel is a metaphorical device which was created back in the autumn of 2008 when we were getting to the climax of the withdrawal agreement. And it was felt that it'd be a good idea for both teams of negotiators to get in there and to have a more protected, sealed environment where stuff wasn't getting leaked out and then getting shot down and causing a big explosion in Westminster in the Tory backbenches. And also, more importantly, that the normal briefing process that the EU has observed, whereby they brief ambassadors from the member states or they brief officials from the member states, that would be scaled back again, so to cut down on leaks and create a more calm environment for people to get to and achieve to a result. The point about the tunnel last time round was we really were in a glide path, if I can mix my metaphors, and it was felt that going into the tunnel there would be an exit at the other end and people could come out holding hands and smiling. That isn't really where things are at the moment, and there's been quite a bit of pushback from various officials in Brussels about this idea of a tunnel because there's still quite a bit of uncertainty surrounding the proposals, which I'll get to in a minute. And for that reason, they're saying, well, look, they're just intensifying negotiations in order to see if we can get an agreement by the European Council next week. The tunnel brings with it sort of connotations of, you know, a deal that's almost there just needs that final push. So far what we understand are in these proposals, and it's been very hard to get detail because people are being extremely secretive about this, but it seems overall that the UK is drifting back towards the original Northern Ireland backstop and the objectives of that backstop, which include obviously no hard border, no customs infrastructure, no controls or related checks, North-South cooperation being preserved, and crucially the All-Ireland economy being preserved. And that can't be preserved according to Ireland or the EU if there is a customs border or if there are related checks and controls. So the feeling is that Britain has taken a bit of a step here, perhaps a leap back over to the EU side. On customs, there's been a bit of chatter about a couple of potential options that would get them down from the ladder on this one, which include this idea of the channels, whereby you would have customs controls at Northern Ireland ports, and you would have a green channel for goods coming from Great Britain that are just going to Northern Ireland. And then you would have a red channel that would be for goods that were going on to the Republic of Ireland and by extension the rest of the EU single market. And the other idea, of course, is Theresa May's new customs partnership idea, which was very complicated when it came out about a year ago and got all sort of snarled up in the Chequers controversy, which obviously prompted Boris Johnson's resignation as Foreign Secretary. But it said that, okay, the UK would have its own customs territory, but it would follow the EU rules on tariffs and quotas. So if goods were coming into the UK and were just going to the UK, then because they were paying the EU tariff, if there was a differential between the UK tariff and the EU tariff, then the importer would get a refund, a rebate. Now, that was very complicated and the EU kind of turned their nose up at it when it was floated. But if you applied that to Northern Ireland, it's a much smaller economy, you know, it might work. So goods going to Northern Ireland that were only destined for Northern Ireland would get a rebate, and it would be done alongside VAT structures. So you could keep an eye on who the importer and exporter was, what their details were. Everything would be controlled to avoid fraud. But then, of course, you wouldn't need a customs border on the island and you would need fewer controls at the ports. But we don't know if either of these two ideas are actually in the mix. But certainly the soundings I'm getting are that Britain has drifted back and perhaps conceded quite a bit on the customs question, and we'll obviously have to see in the next days if that's true or not.
Okay, well, that's the customs end of things. Let's get into the consent end of things as well, because there's a few things being floated here. We have consultation with Stormont, the Stormont Assembly, which isn't in existence or not sitting at the moment. We've had talk floated of a referendum. We've heard talk of a double majority being needed in the Stormont Assembly as well. So the issue of consent stemming from the Good Friday Agreement and being pushed as well by the British government to reassure unionists. And then today, Nigel Evans and Julian Smith as well saying Northern Ireland Secretary Julian Smith saying that no one community would be given a veto. So let's just tease out the issue of consent here in the first instance and what is being floated in that area.
Yes, so the UK proposals, when they were tabled on the 2nd of October, foresaw a consent mechanism for Stormont. People saw it as a Stormont lock. And essentially, it would give Stormont the ability to veto the coming into force of these new arrangements 6 months before the end of the transition period, which would follow ratification of a revised withdrawal agreement. So in other words, before the withdrawal agreement came into effect, and if there wasn't a free trade deal done, and if backstop conditions applied and you would have to have these new measures in place, the Assembly could, in effect, veto that 6 months in advance. And then every 4 years, the Assembly would get to decide whether or not they want to stay in these arrangements if they do come into effect. Now, this was flat out shot down by the European Union when they saw it. This was regarded as an upfront unilateral veto by one party. If you broke it down further, you could say, well, the DUP would have a veto on the opt-in before the end of the transition, and then Sinn Féin might have a veto on the opt-out. So if the DUP wanted to get out in 4 years' time or whatever, then Sinn Féin might be able to block that. So what we're hearing, based on the briefing that Michel Barnier gave to the member states on Friday morning, is that the UK is more content with a majority, a simple majority endorsement of the arrangements. In other words, you wouldn't have the petition of concern mechanism that comes with the Good Friday Agreement. That means both sides have to be on board. It would simply be a majority of people in Stormont in the Assembly, or even it could be a referendum where a majority of the population might agree to this. Now, the reason I'm fuzzy on this is because it's still very early days. That briefing has not long happened. And, you know, the details are not really clear about what consent mechanism we will end up with. But that would be a shift in the British position. It would just allow a simple majority. And you can probably guess that based on polling and based on the very vociferous noises that you Northern Ireland businesses and manufacturing and freight sectors are all saying, that there would be a comfortable majority in Northern Ireland for staying in the single market. And if it is what it is, the customs union as well. But this would also signal a shift for the Irish government, because in essence it would mean that the Irish government would be contemplating a time limit to the backstop if there was going to be some kind of buy-in or consent mechanism agreed for Northern Ireland.
Sean, we have seen movement then on a number of areas here. There was a couple of things that were sacrosanct going into Boris Johnson coming into power. The European Union said that the withdrawal agreement wouldn't be reopened, that was closed. There could only be business done around the political declaration. So if there's any movement there, it's easy to see that 10 Downing Street could sell this as a win. They got the EU to budge, and that this is the difference between Boris Johnson and Theresa May, potentially.
Yeah, but I mean, remember, both sides really do want a deal here. And I think, in a sense, Boris Johnson was right that this thing was going to come down to a last minute arrangement. And here we are in the last minutes of this Brexit process. Well, we're deep into overtime, actually, but this coming summit has always been pitched as the make or break one, and the October 31st deadline has been set as the deadline. So trying to concentrate minds to get to a point of agreement was probably the right thing to do, and trying to ramp up a bit of pressure, certainly on the British side, to come to some kind of an arrangement around something and rally the troops around something. So a lot of the political and media manoeuvrings that have been going on over the past 3 months or so have been pretty much aimed at trying to rally the troops, line people up behind one last big push to get something across the line. And if that means making some concessions along the way, well, so be it. Deals are only get done by concessions being made. And yes, you're right. The EU are plainly saying all the way along, we're not going to reopen the withdrawal agreement. But now, what are we doing this weekend before the summit? We're talking about a change to the withdrawal agreement as it is written. So, you know, changes do come through in the end. As for the bigger ideas of consent and customs territory and stuff, I'd refer you back to Pascal Lamy, who came to Dublin in the autumn of 2017 with this notion of why don't we copy what was done when Britain left Hong Kong and it returned to Chinese sovereignty, the one country, two systems theory, because under WTO rules, you can have a separate customs territory within a single country. That's what Hong Kong and Macau have. They're both independent members of the World Trade Organization. They operate a different customs regime to China, yet they are part of China. Crucially, as he pointed out at the time, it would require not just legislation in the UK, but also an active Northern Ireland administration, the Stormont set up there. They would have to be actually in operation at the time, because they would be the people who would choose to operate a different set of rules to the rest of the United Kingdom. And presumably the rules they would follow would be the EU single market and customs rules. So the architecture has been in place for quite a long time for a deal like this to be done. The question was, how do you sell it to people and how do you bring as many people as possible? And again, the role of the DUP in all of this, well, Arlene Foster was very, very firm last week at the Conservative conference in saying she wanted a deal, even if a lot of people in the room didn't want to hear her saying that she wanted a deal. And Jacob Rees-Mogg, who had been the leader of that European Research Group faction, had been saying, if it's OK by the DUP, then I think the majority of Conservatives and a number of Labour people would rally around and vote for it. So again, the politics has been working away, the technicals have been working away, the architecture has been more or less there. A lot of these things are starting to move into alignment now for one final push, and we'll see if it can be done.
Tony, before I go back to you, it's worth hearing from Phil Hogan, Ireland's commissioner, who was speaking in Cork today. He said two things. Firstly, that Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach, had taken a risk in order to get momentum into this process. And secondly, he said that this was a fine-tuning of the withdrawal agreement. That's presumably how the European Commission would say it. They would play down the significance of their willingness or their shift on reopening the withdrawal agreement, which they set their face against at an earlier point in the Brexit wranglings.
He has certainly have to take some risks from time to time if you want to get an outcome that everybody can live with. There was a stall in the negotiating process between the European Union and the UK in the recent days. So hopefully that this conversation that the Taoiseach has had with Boris Johnson will unlock the impasse and be able to give some momentum for the next few days of negotiations.
Can a deal be passed through Parliament?
Well, we see that there was a difficulty with the last deal. Mr. Johnson, of course, now is trying to fine-tune the deal that was negotiated by Mrs. May to see can they make some changes here and there that would actually have a chance of getting through Parliament. I think there's a good chance, if there is a deal, that the House of Commons will approve it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a risk for Leo Varadkar. First of all, because this entire plan, cooked up in Liverpool, might still fall apart. He's also shifting Ireland's position to an extent if we do end up with a consent mechanism that is a de facto potential expiry date of the backstop. But when Phil Hogan talks about fine-tuning the withdrawal agreement, I think that's a deliberate sort of warning to people that, you know, this is not going to be a wholesale rewriting of it. And also, if you think about the timescale that we have here, the British proposals as tabled are extremely complicated. They have really raised the hackles of the European Commission and member states. So if we were to go down that particular pathway, it would take an awful long time to make it legally operable and politically acceptable, and certainly not within the time frame that Leo Varadkar has envisaged. So that has led people to conclude that what is happening is something that is already there, that's being taken off the shelf and dusted down because it's largely written up as a legal text and had been politically acceptable before to the interlocutors, if not the House of Commons. So I think Phil Hogan's remarks were just a signal that that's going to be the direction of travel, and certainly that would be backed up by some of the soundings that we've heard so far in terms of Michel Barnier's briefing on this and other contacts and sources.
It's worth hearing from another arm of the Irish government at this point. Simon Coveney last night speaking at a Dublin Chamber of Commerce event saying, let's not get carried away.
But I think it's important that we don't get carried away. there is still a significant amount of work to be done. That work needs to happen in Brussels, not bilaterally between our two countries. It needs to happen between the task force and the UK negotiators. But I do believe it is possible to now get a deal before the end of October.
We're not there yet, Sean, are we? There's still Westminster as a hurdle to be gotten through, and there's a lot of things could happen between now and any progress being really seen in the actual negotiations.
Oh, there is plenty of things go wrong. And as Tony says, what's being asked here is immensely difficult, and the time available is really, really short. The complexity of the British proposals that were tabled, trying to winnow that down into something that can go through the co-repair on Monday and be ready for approval by the leaders on Thursday, it's, you know, looks like mission impossible. I think there will have to be more time taken somewhere in this, whether the British government are able to sell it to the House of Commons and say, and their supporters in the country, yes, we have the makings of a deal here, but we need a technical extension beyond the 31st. But essentially, we have it in the bag. We're on our way out. You know, that might buy them additional time to work through the technical aspects of this that Tony has alluded to. In the meantime, politics as usual is going on in this country. People are manoeuvring for a general election because, as we know, this government doesn't have a majority. So what can it do besides Brexit? This is the big mission of the Johnson administration, certainly in its current incarnation. They have to get Brexit done or be taken out for not getting it done. And that's the reality that faces them. So minds are being concentrated by that fact as well. And whether individuals within the party see now as the moment to push, to collapse things, to try and get what they call a clean break Brexit, this is the one without a deal, or those supporters who want to get a deal to get it through, or indeed if they can persuade people who are fundamentally Remainers, people who want to stay in the European Union, but who think it's better to have a deal than a no-deal breakout, and whether they would come across and vote with the bulk of the Conservative Party. All that numbers game, as we mentioned earlier, that's still going on as well.
Right, as the fellow at the glass morgue says, remains to be seen. Tony, what's going on in the week ahead on your end of things?
Yeah, well, we expect these negotiations to pick up probably over the weekend. We're not supposed to call it a tunnel, so let's just call it negotiations for the moment. Then on Monday, EU foreign ministers are going to meet in Luxembourg for one of their regular meetings, and there'll obviously be a fair amount of talk at that. I'll be there reporting for RTE on any Brexit developments. Then on Tuesday, also in Luxembourg, Michel Barnier will brief the members of the General Affairs Council. That's essentially European affairs ministers from around Europe, and that will be a very decisive update on what's been happening since then. So if we are going for a simple off-the-shelf Northern Ireland only backstop style arrangement, then we could even have a breakthrough by then. But of course, we'll have to see what goes on in the negotiations and how far Britain has moved. And then, of course, there's the European Council, the long-awaited European Council, the big summit happening on Thursday and Friday. And that will be, again, a very key decisive moment when the heads of government themselves get together to assess the state of play. They were going to be talking about the seven-year budget and probably Turkey's invasion of northern Syria. But of course, Brexit will be a massive item on the agenda, and, you know, again, another huge landmark in this whole saga.
All right, and I'll see you there for that. Sean, what's going on in your neck of the woods over the coming week?
Well, we've all sorts of things going on. The Parliament right now is prorogued. It was suspended the other night. Nobody really mentioned it or missed it amidst all the other drama that was going on. But it's a proper lawful suspension this time to set up for a Queen's speech, a formal state opening of a new session of Parliament. That's happening on Monday down our street on Millbank. It had been full up with Extinction Rebellion protesters. They were all removed during the night by the police, and there's now a sort of a miniature Berlin Wall type scene all around the Parliament as it's prepared for the security measures that are necessary to guard for the formal opening of Parliament, when the Queen will come in her golden carriage, we think. But there's a fair amount of ceremonial going on there. But there's all kinds of concrete barricades and steel fences have sprung up all around the Westminster area. The MPs are supposed to debate this government programme on Tuesday and Wednesday. That's supposed to keep them busy while whatever's going on in Brussels goes on in Brussels. Then it'll be wait and watch and see what happens at the European Council. And then
Super Saturday.
Yeah, they haven't done this since the Falklands War, apparently, but the Parliament is going to have be in session on a Saturday. And that's important because Saturday the 19th is the date that's contained in the Benn Act. In case Mr. Johnson comes back from Brussels with either a deal in the bag, if he can't get a deal in the bag, then he can propose to the House that they vote for a no-deal Brexit. And if he can't get that through the House, and it's pretty unlikely he would, then he's supposed to comply with the law and write this magic letter back to Brussels saying, please, can we have an extension? We need to get this thing sorted out. And as we know, Brussels has previously said, we'd grant an extension either for an election or a second referendum. Well, that remains to be seen what happens there. But you can imagine all kinds of shenanigans going on in the House on Super Saturday. There's also
Is everyone calling it Super Saturday?
Confidence motion. Oh, yeah, yeah. Lots of people are calling it Super Saturday. All it's newspapers, websites, you put in Super Saturday and it won't be just sports events you'll find.
Right, not super for you. Okay, that's it for another edition of Brexit Republic. From me, Colm O'Mungine, RTÉ's Deputy Foreign Editor in Dublin.
And me, Sean Whelan, RTÉ's London Correspondent in London.
And from me, Tony Connolly, RTÉ's Europe Editor in Brussels. Thanks for listening.